Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be able to hear a recent conversation Dr. Edward Aglesia had with science journalist and athlete Christy Ajwandan about her new book, Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. Really important conversation. I'm so glad that my colleague, Dr. Aglesia, was able to do this interview because I think we all have injuries. We all are looking to recover, whether it's a sprained ankle, a torn ligament in the knee, a knee replacement, a hip replacement, injuries, sports. What's science? What is science fiction? What do we need to know? First, though, we're going to actually talk about some research that matters. And I think the very first one is one I had heard about and wanted to understand a little bit better. And that is about a potential new treatment that will be available, hopefully sometime soon, about treating peanut allergies. And this is actually research that was in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. And it was about a new type of immunotherapy, something that kind of stimulates our own system to either react or not react or do something a little bit that can be protective. And it's called sublingual immunotherapy, or SLIT. And this was talking about putting a very small amount of liquid peanut protein under the tongue, where it not goes through the gastrointestinal tract, which then can stimulate some of the reactivity that people have with these peanut allergies, but yet it could go straight into the bloodstream and seems to have less of an immediate effect on the reactivity and maybe just help to desensitize the immune system to larger amounts of peanut protein. And we know that this is one of three different ways that scientists have tried to work to actually desensitize kids to peanut allergies. And the idea here is not to have kids go out and eat their peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or to, as I do sometimes, just take handfuls of peanuts when you're on the go and have like 5 minutes between meetings to get to see patients. But it's to say, well, there's so many foods that are made and processed in places where peanut oils are sometimes processed. Like the other day, I discovered that virtually all oral contraceptives, if you look on the warnings, will say that there may be some cross-reactivity. I haven't seen that ever clinically, but very few things say that they are not made without any reservoir. And so for someone who has true peanut allergy, these things can be really important here. And because it doesn't take a lot of exposure to really cause what would call a severe allergic reaction. And so, you know, one approach involves putting a patch on the skin to release the protein over time. It's not approved by the Food and Drug Administration. It could become approved, and this is something down the road. A second approach is taking something, an oral approach, oral immunotherapy, which may be approved later this day, and that involves taking something orally each day and increasing the amount. And then a third approach is this sublingual, putting it right underneath the tongue, and rather than going again through the stomach, it's really absorbed pretty much right into the bloodstream. And they're given very little of this peanut protein. And then again, of course, it's increased over time. And this was research was done by, again, Dr. Kim and colleagues at the University of North Carolina. And they did it in one study with 18 patients, and they did it with another study with 48 patients. And they find that over two-thirds can tolerate this at escalating doses without serious side effects. And some can tolerate very high doses. It seems to be that the sublingual is as effective as the oral, even though the dose is much smaller. I think this is still early in many respects. These are small numbers compared to the large numbers where you might expect if there is going to be an issue. But I do think this is an important advancement, and I think we should stay tuned because I think this will become available sooner rather than later for patients. Our next research that matters is not about necessarily a diagnostic test, but a diagnostic sensitivity we must have really about adolescent boys, young adult men. We do know appropriately that we have to be really concerned about eating disorders in adolescent women, young adult women. But I don't think clinicians, maybe even parents, are really as aware that adolescent boys, young adult boys, have eating disorders. And it may not be associated necessarily with weight loss. It may be associated with actually excessive compulsive exercise. It may be associated with excessive compulsive weightlifting, bodybuilding, wanting to increase muscle mass, eating too much protein, taking protein supplements, strict reductions in carbohydrates and fats, overconsumption, calorie cutting, again, all trying to build muscle, taking steroids or supplements. These are the sorts of things that are hallmarks of eating disorders in boys. And I bring it up because I think this important research that's being put out really helps us begin to understand. This was research put out by colleagues in the University of California, San Francisco, and a commentary in International Journal Lancet, Child and Adolescent Health. I think we'll ask our great librarians at the Health Sciences Library to maybe put a link, if they can, to this article so our parents can read a little bit more about that and be more sensitive. We should be able to hopefully make impacts early and prevent as many, if not all, if we can, on eating disorders in both young adult women, young adult men, teenage women, and teenage men. What about our next research that matters? And this is about research on norovirus. We see over 20 million people in the United States annually actually get this. This is that cruise ship virus where it just runs through and you may have hundreds of people get it. The cruise ships frequently come back to shore. I've seen it in my role as a physician at youth camps, and you'll see 60-100. I've been in on missions where I've taken teams to sports teams, and we had 1,000 delegation sports, and we had 150 of the athletes and their parents come down with the norovirus within 1, 2, 3 days, overwhelming our capacities at times. And this is research really trying to help us discover both an antibody that could lead to a vaccine that could then help prevent this disease. And what they're basically doing, these are researchers who are really much smarter than me, really looking at with people who have had the norovirus before, who already are exposed, who already have antibodies, and helping really do the research with these people to help then find out what are the things that can help increase antibody levels and maybe targeting a vaccine that then offers long-term protection. I mentioned this research not because it's going to have impact today, but it will have impact tomorrow. As we all think about supporting science, as we all think about supporting the National Institute of Health science budgets, this is the type of research that could make a translation between what's seeing in the bench to what's seeing in the clinic. And while it may not be available today, it may be available hopefully in our lifetimes, hopefully making a difference, because this is a devastating disease that really does negatively impact millions of people. And the last research that matters is one that should be near and dear to all of us. It's near and dear to myself. And it is the first time we have a ray of hope, a glimpse of something positive, really, about opioid deaths. This is actually research out of North Carolina. It's mirrored in what we see nationally, which 2018 was the first time in 5 years that opioid overdose deaths declined. It happened in North Carolina. It happened around the country, about 5% decline. Lest one get too optimistic, it means that there were 1,884 opioid accidental overdose deaths in North Carolina in 2017. They went down to 1,785 in 2018. Yes, 1,785 preventable deaths due to opioids. There are so many efforts underway. I have to really give credit to the Dr. Mandy Cohen, who was on Your Health 1 or 2 years ago, really talking about the comprehensive opioid reduction plan that Governor Cooper was really supporting the legislature to really work on a comprehensive, multifaceted plan to reduce opioid deaths in the state. Other states are also implementing these plans, and it's beginning to show impact. We're reducing by so many different factors: physician education, patient education, pharmacist education, media work, really helping figure out and understand. There's so much work still to be done, but I at least have a little bit of optimism that perhaps we have turned a tide and we need to accelerate that downturn. That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll get to listen in on a really important conversation Dr. Ed Aglesia had with science journalist and athlete Christian Ajwandan recently about her new book, Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. I'm Dr. Eddie Aglesia, and today on Conversations, we'll be talking with science journalist and athlete Christy Ajwandan about her new book, Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. Welcome, Christy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we begin, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you went from star high school and collegiate athlete to becoming a science writer.
Sure. So I ended up getting a degree in biology at University of Colorado, and I thought I was going to be a scientist. I am sort of have always been a little bit of a science geek and was on my way to doing that. After college, I worked as a researcher for a while. I was doing that, sort of trying to figure out what I was going to specialize in for my PhD in science. But as I was doing this, I realized that it was very hard for me to pick one thing. And what I sort of figured out then is that I'm more of a generalist than a specialist, and I had very broad interests. But I also realized that I was actually pretty good at writing, and it was something that I enjoyed to some degree. And so I ended up switching careers, and I went to a graduate program at University of California, Santa Cruz, to study science journalism. And so I did that, and I've been a science writer ever since. And it's something that has sort of allowed me to combine these two loves of mine, one being sport and the other science.
Can you elaborate a little bit more about your experience writing for The Washington Post and 538 and what you've learned there?
Yeah. So for about 4.5 years, I was a lead science writer at 538, and that was really fun. It was a great job. It allowed me to really dig into data, which is something I love to do, and really sort of become a data journalist. And at 538, I was able to do some really amazing projects where I actually got to dig into data and actually play around with it. So, for instance, one story that I did, the headline was something like, "You can't trust what you read about nutrition." And we actually looked into the methodologies behind a lot of nutrition studies that you read about. And what I found is that some of these methodologies were pretty unreliable. And so what we did is we actually did our own study using the same methodology, and we were able to prove to the same extent that these other studies would be proving anything. We use those techniques in order to find an association between, for instance, potato chip consumption and math aptitude. And I think my favorite one, though, that we were able to find was that people who cut the fat off their steaks were more likely to be atheists than people who ate the fat, you know, their God-given fat on their steaks.
Well, so a true scientist wanting to attempt to replicate something that's already been out there.
Right. I'm still an experimentalist at heart, for sure.
But here we are now. You're fresh off writing this newly published work. What inspired you to write Good to Go? I'm thinking I could have used your writing when I ran a half marathon 5 years ago on very little training.
Uh-huh. Sure. So I used to be a pretty serious athlete. I was an elite cross-country skier on a professional team. I also have been a bike racer and a runner. And recovery is just something that's really important. And I think it's something that over the course of my career, I realized was maybe more important than I had initially been, you know, giving it the attention that it deserved. And so sort of my growing recognition about the importance of recovery. But then the other thing that really motivated me to write this book is that I observed that this had become sort of a new marketing area for a lot of companies and, you know, products and things. And what I saw was a lot of seemingly sort of like pseudoscientific explanations for things and a lot of marketing that was sort of masquerading as science. And so I wanted to look into this and kind of separate the science from the marketing and you know, the things that were backed up by actual evidence from things that were just sort of pseudoscience and, you know, nonsense.
Can you orient us a little bit to the sports recovery industry, where the industry is now? How has it changed over the past few decades?
Sure. It's really grown a lot over the last decade or so. And it's everything from, you know, of course, there's things like sports drinks and different nutritional products that are marketed for after a workout. So the idea is like, okay, you're done with your workout. You need to recover by taking in this protein shake or drinking the sports drink, things like that. So I have chapters on all of those things. But the other thing is there's been a proliferation of products. For instance, foam rollers are one thing that have become really popular where people sort of their muscles on these rolling devices. There are also things like pneumatic compression pants, which kind of squeeze the muscles in the legs. And also there are devices that will go on arms. So it's sort of like a mechanical massage. There's something called cupping, which involves putting like glass cups usually on the skin, creating a suction, and it sort of pulls the skin up. And
yeah, I think that was made famous by Michael Phelps, perhaps.
It was, yeah. He showed up in the pool with all these bruises and people were saying, you know, what the hell's going on? And it turns out that, you know, cupping is really just a way of giving yourself bruises. It's said to increase circulation, but it doesn't do that. You know, your blood's not circulating if it's forming, you know, a bruise underneath your skin.
So you talk about how some of these therapies might not work. They might not be efficacious. But what is the harm to some of these methods that are out there?
Well, there's numerous harms. One is I have a whole chapter in the book about supplements, and nutritional supplements are that's a whole other industry that could be, you know, a whole book in and of itself. And in fact, some very good books have been written about the vitamin and supplement industry. But there's a real sense among athletes that they need to take supplements. And part of this is driven by the fact that supplement companies are major sponsors of many sporting events. So they're really being sort of urged by, you know, the industry itself giving money to the federations and to teams and to individuals even, that they need to use these products. But as I document in the book, there are a lot of athletes now who are testing positive on drug tests, you know, for doping products that they inadvertently ingested in one of these products. And this is a common enough problem that, you know, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency has a whole campaign now to try and urge athletes to use more caution. But it's really tricky because they can't come out and say outright, do not use these products, because so many of them are sponsoring some of the teams. And so it's a very sort of awkward dance that they have to do. So that's one harm, that people could be ingesting, you know, harmful substances. There have been instances where, say, protein powders had heavy metals and other contaminants. There have been, you know, a lot of nutritional supplements will have undeclared drugs. This is something I get press releases from the FDA pretty regularly about, where they found products that have been laced with drugs that aren't supposed to be in them. I mean, it's just a very unregulated industry, and so it's very difficult to know what you're getting. So that's one harm. Another harm is that you have athletes who are wasting a lot of time and money and anxiety and sort of worry over things that don't matter and over things that aren't going to help them. And so if the purpose of recovery is to allow your body to sort of rest and recover, it's hard to do that when recovery has become sort of its own source of stress, and when people are, you know, feeling a lot of anxiety that they may be missing out on something, and that there's something they need to be doing that they're not, or that the companies really create this sort of sense that everyone's doing these things and you need to do them, and if you don't, you know, you might not have that advantage and your rival may have something on you.
So it sounds like there's a lot of buyer beware in the marketplace with all this. I've heard some parts of the industry, for example, perhaps the dairy industry, likes to tout chocolate milk as just being just as good as some of these protein powders or these protein shakes. Is there any truth to something like that?
Sure. So it is interesting. You're right that a lot of this is driven by manufacturers or producers looking for new markets for their products. And it turns out that chocolate milk is a very fine recovery drink. It's, you know, definitely a good thing to drink after a workout. Is it the absolute best thing? Well, maybe, maybe not. But what's happened is people are, you know, this marketing really convinces people that there are certain things that are absolutely essential. So chocolate milk is a perfectly good recovery drink, but it's not the only choice. And it may be, you know, many people may find that it's a better choice than some of the other, you know, sports drinks and things that are marketed for this purpose. But I think the danger here is that thinking that one particular product or another is going to be the answer or the perfect solution to things. So chocolate milk's fine. A lot of people don't drink milk. Some people can't tolerate it. And so, you know, it should really be thought of as one possible choice among many.
We need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with science journalist and athlete Kristi Aschwanden about her new book, Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. We'll be right back with Your Health.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Kristi Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with science journalist and athlete Kristi Aschwanden about her new book, Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. We were previously discussing some of the harms that some recovery products can bestow on athletes and users of these products. Perhaps, Kristi, you can discuss about some either treatments or products or strategies that are actually effective in helping with recovery.
Sure. It was really interesting. You know, during the course of reporting the book, I really looked at, you know, looked very far and wide. I tried all kinds of goofy things. But at the end of the day, when I had finished, you know, looking at all of the evidence, there was one thing that really came out on top. And it was something that was, you know, if there's a magic elixir for recovery, this is it. And this thing is sleep. And it's interesting because it's something that we all know we need to do, but it's also something that people tend to really struggle to get right. Sleep is when your body makes repairs. It's when a lot of the recovery that an athlete needs actually happens. And it's not in the gym when you're lifting the weight that your muscle gets stronger. It's the actual repair process where the body is repairing itself from the damage that you did from those workouts, where your muscles get stronger and, you know, the endurance that you build. Those changes and those adaptations actually happen during the recovery phase. And sleep is really the primary time at which this stuff happens. And so it's just absolutely essential for athletes and for people of all walks of life, I'll add. But it's something that people just so routinely neglect and they skimp on. And a lot of people say, oh, I can get by on 6 hours of sleep. But what I found out in my research is that most people actually can't get by on 6 hours of sleep. And people who believe that they're doing fine are really probably fooling themselves, because it turns out that people who are chronically sleep deprived basically lose the ability to sort of notice their impairment. Being like too tired and being sleep impaired sort of becomes the new normal. And so you don't even realize the extent to which you're really not operating at full speed.
So it sounds like for elite athletes and casual athletes alike, perhaps sleep is the prescription for proper recovery.
It absolutely is. And it's really interesting. I think that there is a growing recognition about this. Naps have become extremely popular in the NBA. In fact, there's kind of a joke among people in the industry and the NBA that you don't call players at 3 o'clock in the afternoon because that's when everyone's taking their naps. And this is something that a lot of professional athletes have really taken up. And this is something that's become popular, where people are taking naps, but also just really prioritizing sleep. And that's what it takes. To get sleep right, you have to make it a priority. And sleep has to be something that's as important to you as training. Because if it isn't, you're just not going to be able to get the sleep that you need. It's so easy in the world that we're living in today. We have so many demands on our time and attention, and it's really easy to have the best intention of going to bed at, you know, say 10:30, but then next thing you know, it's almost midnight because you decided to just check email one more time before bed, and oops, there went an hour, you know, things like that. So it really, I think we're living at a time where getting good sleep almost takes some deliberate thought and planning.
Other than sleep, can you touch on some other methods that you tried yourself that you found to be effective or found to be effective in your research?
Yeah, so another really important one that I came across that was a little bit surprising to me, just in terms of the importance that it has, is managing stress. It turns out that to your body, stress is stress, and so life stress can be just as detrimental, you know, and sort of stressful to your body as training stress. And so if you have a lot of stress in your life, you know, problems at work, at home, whatever it is that's creating stress, that sort of impairs your body's ability to recover from the exercise training as well. And so if you are in a time of a lot of stress, it's going to be harder for you to perform at your best. So you really need to figure out ways of managing stress. So a lot of the things that are actually most effective for recovery are things that are really addressing the stress in someone's life. So things like meditation, mindfulness, some people like yoga. I actually tried this fun, interesting thing for the book that I did not expect to like. It's now called floating. It used to be called sensory deprivation chambers. But basically, you get into this little tank. It's very small and sort of contained, filled with just a very shallow amount of very salty water. So your body's very buoyant and you sort of float in this nice water, which is body temperature. So it's sort of neither hot nor cold. It's quiet. It's dark. I like to think of it as forced meditation. It's a way of really letting go of stress, setting aside all external demands on our time and attention. And I found this to be a really effective way of sort of unwinding and letting go of the stress in my life. But it's something that people get just through normal meditation that they can do at home. And so that was something that really rose to the top as well, just any sort of thing. And I don't think that there's one method, you know, one particular type of meditation or floating or yoga, whatever it is, that's better than another. But the thing that seemed to be really effective is to deal with stress and sort of let it go and you know, rid the body and the mind at some point of all of these sort of, you know, internal stressors.
Sounds very effective. Was there a strategy or a method that was particularly goofy? What was the goofiest thing that you tried?
Yes, I tried the meditation app with like a headband that was supposed to be reading my brainwaves. And it turned out that, you know, if you were really getting into the right meditative state, they would have little birds chirping. And so it was sort of gamifying meditation. Like, you want to try and make the birds sing. But what I found is that I could sort of game this by trying to feel really agitated at the start of the session. I could get more birds if I did that. You know, it was all by comparison. So it was interesting. And just seeing, I think, just the mere fact that people were trying to turn meditation into a game seemed sort of maybe a statement on the state of the world today.
Great. So you're currently attending the Endurance Coaching Summit in Boulder, Colorado. How's your book and your work being received? And can you give us an on-the-floor view over there?
Yeah, so this conference is great. It's a training conference for coaches, a lot of speakers about endurance issues. But my book has been really gratifying, the reception that it's gotten. And I would say the number one response that I get from people, and I'm getting it from coaches here at this conference, but I've gotten it in letters and tweets and, you know, other points of contact from readers, is that just sort of a huge feeling of gratitude. And it's almost like people are really happy for the permission to not worry about some of the stuff that they sort of suspected didn't matter, but there was always a question. And so I think people are very relieved to know that the most important things really are the fundamentals, the basic things that we know we need to do: sleep, address stress, you know, get enough sleep, find some time every day where you're just relaxing and you have an unscheduled time to unwind. Focusing on this is the stuff that will really get the most payoff. And I think people have been really happy to hear that and been really grateful for the permission to not get bogged down with this other stuff that's, you know, frankly, they're being bombarded with marketing about it all the time. And so I think people just are really happy to know that they can ignore that stuff.
So it sounds like the science of recovery isn't so strange after all, if it's the basic fundamentals that are very important for this.
It absolutely is. That's right. Stick to the basics and you'll be great.
So we've been talking with science journalist and athlete Christy Aschwanden about her new book, Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. Christiana, thank you for being on the show today and sharing your research and your wisdom about how to properly recover from exercise and endurance training.
Thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segments of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I live in a college town where recently they had a case of mumps reported on campus. I'm curious, should I get a booster for myself?
If you had all of your shots and it was documented, it's not recommended you get a booster. If you didn't, then yes, you should be checked and have that booster. We've seen, I think, in the North and South Carolinas, there have been almost a dozen cases that have been seen recently among people who probably have not been fully vaccinated. And, you know, to get into college, you really do have to show that you've had vaccination, unless you have a medical or religious exemption.
So there are some exceptions.
Yeah. I don't think we know how many exceptions there are.
Right.
And I don't know if we know how many of those who have the new mumps cases are ones who've been exposed, who were not vaccinated. I think these are, you know, some of the questions that, you know, really we need to find out. In the United States in 2019, I think there's close to 800 cases of mumps. That's an increase of hundreds of cases. Somehow this seems like it's also related to, you know, the surge in measles. This is related to people who perhaps are under vaccinated, not vaccinated. I think there, you know, there's really an important issue here that for us to confront,
right,
which is these are diseases that should be eradicated. Mumps can be serious.
Yeah, what is the risk of mumps? As someone who was lucky enough to kind of grow up before the under-vaccination trend started, what are the risks?
Well, the biggest risk would be more in adults than in children.
Okay.
And there's something called orchitis, inflammation of the testicle, the organs of the testicle. Then they swell and become painful. 1 in 5 males with mumps. The more severe complications could be viral meningitis. I've seen one case when I was in training.
Okay.
And so it's not necessarily always a benign illness.
Right.
And I just think that people should be aware. People should, if any questions, ask their doctors.
Great.
What's our very next house call?
My 18-year-old is a high school athlete and makes great grades. I was really surprised, however, when I saw them recently hide something in their pocket quickly, which turned out to be a Juul pod. With all the concern over the news about vaping, where can I send my son to get some help, as I'm worried this could derail his future?
Well, I think it's not just about the future of academics or athletics, which may not be exactly fully what the parent was saying, but it is health issues as well. I mean, I think one thing we've learned in the recent episode of deaths across the United States and increase vaping-associated respiratory disease across the United States is there's more that we don't know than what we do know.
Right.
What we don't know is to what extent these vaping-associated illnesses are really from Juul or other forms of electronic nicotine delivery systems versus other vaping-associated behaviors associated with marijuana or other elements. There's some evidence that I've seen that it may be contaminated marijuana that's being sold illegally. Well, since, you know, many places and states in the United States, it's not legal to sell. It will be illegal. And so it's the Wild West.
Right.
Vaping substances that are unregulated are not usually safe.
Right.
And so I think what we don't know is to what extent the electronic nicotine delivery systems have some role in this. Since many of them are dual users, are using both electronic nicotine delivery systems as well as vaping marijuana. Is it a combination? Is it one versus the other? It just causes us some cause for concern. The other element that we know for certain is that it's addictive.
Right.
Even electronic nicotine delivery for the, now, if the kids were adolescent cigarette smokers and they went completely to the vaping and then they're moving to completely off of all forms of tobacco, maybe that's a good thing.
That's a good trend.
A lot of these kids were not cigarette smokers. They began vaping because it was cool, because it, the mm-hmm. advertisement, because of the marketing, because of the flavors, all of the things. And we know that levels of nicotine are very high and can be very addictive.
Wow. Scary stuff.
Yeah. And so what can be done? Well, you need to get children who are addicted frequently into people who know how to treat addiction. There are tobacco treatment specialists. There are physicians who specialize in addiction. There are therapists who specialize in addiction. It's not as simple as just telling them no. Because if they're addicted, what are they going to do if they're just told no? What happens within hours of them no longer vaping? They're going through withdrawal.
No.
And withdrawal and cues, and it becomes incredibly physically uncomfortable, psychologically right. uncomfortable, and it probably doesn't really work for many of them, so they need treatment.
Yeah, that's great advice and something that parents should remember when their first impulse might be to get angry.
Yeah, know. And I don't think punishment in any form or fashion on this is the right way of going.
Right.
What's our very last house call?
My mother's 89, and while that seems old, she's still pretty vibrant, and she gets out every day. She likes to garden, and she likes to go to church. However, she does have arthritis all over her body, and she was curious if it's okay for her to use CBD oil. Do you think it is?
Oh, well, thank you for a really easy question here. You know, I'm going to tell an 89-year-old.
Talk about the Wild West a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell an 89-year-old or their children about what can and can't be done. No, thank you.
Yeah.
But I will say that I get questions every week from a patient asking about CBD oil. Does it work for chronic
right.
pain? Does it work for lots of other things? But chronic pain is what I hear a lot of. And usually it's, I tried CBD oil and it seemed to work. Or I tried CBD oil and it didn't work. They mm-hmm. kind of tell me, and I say pretty much the same thing both times. Thank you for letting me know. It's helpful because there's just very little research on this to know, is it safe and is it effective? I would say that there are people making a lot of money off selling CBD oil, and there's a lot of people taking CBD oil. And I always want to know who's making a profit.
Yeah, and, who benefits?
Who benefits? And, yeah. and I'm not saying that in a necessarily a negative way. It could be the profit could be you're getting better.
Yeah.
Because better is better.
Can you explain what CBD oil is?
So we're talking about cannabinoids, and mm-hmm. unlike the THC, the tetrahydrocannabinol, which is found in marijuana, CBD does not produce this psychoactive effect
okay.
or high. It's at different receptors, and so that it's found that it's not as regulated and it's not as felt to be as dangerous potentially or psychoactively effective
gotcha.
As the other. So the problem is that it, you know, there are side effects. It can cause fatigue. It can cause diarrhea. It can change appetite or weight. There's just ways we don't know. It could be a dry mouth, blood pressure, drowsiness. It could help with pain too. We don't really fully know
right.
under what conditions. In this particular case, at age 89, I don't think it'd be my first, second, or third choice. I might find out and really work with them on, you know, acetaminophen, which is
right.
safe and effective, maybe at the right dose. And I might try some non-medication regimens, including some very gentle massage,
okay.
some stretching, and maybe even some thermo, some very light heat treatments, things like that. That I know aren't going to really have negative side effects.
Right. Go better safe than sorry.
Yeah. Well, that will conclude our house call today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can share any concern by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, our guest co-host today, Dr. Ed Aglesia, and our guest today, Christy Ashwanden. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.